Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the new podcast here at SIHS for Black History Month. I'm your host, Ever Allen Hood. Today we have Mr. Turner, class of 81, as our first official guest. We hope whoever turns into this podcast enjoys. So, to start off, Mr. Turner, could you just please introduce yourself?
Well, great. Good afternoon. My name is Milton Allen Turner. As you said, I'm a classmate of 1981 from St. Ignatius, and since 1987, I've been teaching French and Spanish at St. Ignatius, as well as I did a little three-year stint as an administrator, as Dean of Academic Administration, before returning back to the classroom full-time.
I'm told that you actually know about 12 languages in total?
Something like that. I have six or seven well, but probably about 10 or 12 in total. I was fortunate enough to do a Fulbright in Thailand and Vietnam in the early 2000s. So at the time, I could order and count and greet people in Thai and Vietnamese. I wouldn't really count that now, but at the time, it was good enough for me to get through and get my meals and get on a bus and find out what we were doing for the day.
That's certainly interesting. So I'm just curious, what led you to St. Ignatius High School prior to being a student?
Actually, it was my grade school principal, my mother, and my grandmother. I was a student at St. Henry, which now is Archbishop Like, but I went through kindergarten through eighth grade at St. Henry's on Harvard. And my mother was very good friends with the principal, Sister Jean Anthony. In fact, my mother started the lunchroom program there. And I just thought I was going to go to Chanel, because from St. Henry's, all the smart kids went to Chanel and all the athletic kids went to Benedictine. So I just figured I was going to Chanel. And my mother, my grandmother, and Sister Jean Anthony said, "No, you want to try St. Ignatius." I'm like, "Okay." And it's like, "Where's St. Ignatius?" "On the west side." Again, I grew up in Lee Harvard area. I'm like, "Where's the west side?" For me, there was downtown and the airport and this huge vacuum in between. But they convinced us to go and take the test for St. Ignatius. I got admitted on the test. They also had me apply for a scholarship, which originally they said I didn't get. And then about 2 months before school started in the summer, we got this letter saying that I got a three-quarter scholarship for tuition at St. Ignatius. And so that nailed the deal. Even if I didn't want to go, my mother and grandmother were like, "No, you're not turning down money." So I became a St. Ignatius student.
What did you say would be your favorite thing when you came here?
Oh, my favorite thing. The academic challenge and the rigor. Perhaps unlike a lot of people, when I was at St. Ignatius, St. Ignatius were not the best 4 years of my life. There were lots of my experiences at St. Ignatius I was not very happy with. And frankly, after I graduated, I thought I was never going to step foot on campus again. But I realized it made me a stronger person. It prepared me very well academically for Georgetown and other things in my life. And I actually enjoyed the classroom and the academic rigors in the classroom. It was a lot of the other social issues and problems that I had a much bigger problem with. And frankly, that was one of the issues that once I was invited, asked to come back as a teacher, my first reaction was no. But after a while thinking about it, I was like, you know, I kind of want to do whatever I can to make sure nobody has an experience like I did.
Yeah, I can probably agree that when I came here, the academic rigor was probably the most thing that that got me interested in St. Ignatius, because I like challenging myself academically. But like other things like socially or ironically religiously, and sometimes service wise, it's a little hard to get into or wrap my head around. But I think that academic rigor was always there and always pushing me throughout my 4 years here.
Actually, it was interesting when you mentioned religiously. One of the things I found very odd about St. Ignatius is I'm a Catholic, and a Catholic my whole life, went to St. Henry's, as I said. And yet when I came to Ignatius, I was often treated as if I was an outsider and not a Catholic, or that somehow Black Catholic charism was somehow separate or different. So much so that actually I became part of a group that was run by the diocese called Black Catholic Input, and I did all of my retreats and religious experiences through them, because I felt such a strange difference and distance between the kind of Catholicism I experienced at St. Henry's or St. Aloysius or even at St. Dominic's as opposed to St. Henry's. It was almost as if it was a different religion. And it's like, I'm Catholic and I was treated as if I were a Baptist or a heretic.
Yeah, I can feel the same way here too, because I was never baptized, and I don't have as many religious experiences with church as other people. But there's a certain faint emptiness that I feel connected with religion here, going to mass and whatnot, that I kind of wish I had. But it's I've actually researched this a little. There's a bit of a disconnect when it comes to Catholicism and African Americans in America, and we're slowly getting there, I'd say.
Right.
Especially with you know, Dr. Richard Phillips, Mr. Sanders, and their work with, you know, the Welsh Academy and whatnot. But yeah, I think maybe Catholicism as a whole has a lot to go when it comes to racial diversity and inclusion.
Right. Senor Torres and I talk about this quite a bit, that the church around the world looks a lot more like we do, like Senor Torres and me, than it does in some of the others. But it's in the United States and pertaining Northeast Ohio in particular, there's this perception that it is a white, Irish, Westside Catholic. And then the diversity within the church is not as much a lived experience yet. Hopefully it will be soon, but there's a very specific view of what's supposed to be Catholic, and the whole name of Catholic or Universalist makes it almost ironic that it should be through the diversity that we have those. And it's also very non-Jesuit, that the idea that the Jesuit idea that God is constantly looking for us and trying to show his love for us in so many different ways, and to try to narrow those experiences into very specific, defined, quantifiable experiences is rather odd.
Yeah, I can't agree more. You are first in a lot of things here, from, for instance, being the first administrator, being the first teacher of color here, and, you know, a variety of awards too, like Best Teacher Award in 2014. I was just wondering, how do you feel when you receive these various awards for your accomplishments?
Well, happy. It's almost become par for the course, unfortunately. When I was first hired, I didn't realize I was the first Black at Ignatius. For some reason, I knew when I was a student, I hadn't seen any Black teachers, but I just assumed in the almost 100-year history of the school before I got there that there was somebody before me. And it was actually my first year. I was reading an article in The Eye where they were doing the write-up about all the new teachers. And it said, Mr. Turner, the first lay African-American teacher at St. Ignatius. I'm like, what? I didn't sign up to be Jackie Robinson. What do you mean the first? That wasn't part of the contract. But too late then. So I just sort of went along with it. So it just wasn't something that I expected, but just sort of just rolled to the punches and did. Actually, one of the strangest things for me of the first was, which a lot sometimes people don't know or realize, was that I was the first webmaster and created the first two versions of the website at St. Ignatius. So when people say first, that's actually one of the first I was proud of, that kicking and clawing was able to bring us into the 21st century, and work quite a bit with our director of technology at the time, Mickey Benedict, into getting two school-wide networks and actually giving us a web presence. So before Mr. Jerk took over for me afterwards, but I designed the first two versions of the Ignatius website.
Would you say, similar to Jackie Robinson, that you've ever had backlash for being the first?
Oh, yes. Well, I wouldn't say that I've had direct backlash necessarily at being the first, but I have felt very strong pushback for, again, trying to move the school in a particular direction that can be viewed as more inclusive, because often this idea of inclusion and diversity is mistakenly confused with a lack of, that somehow by becoming more diverse, we become less Catholic, when it's actually the opposite. And I think a lot of this is off of fear, because there is a fear, particularly in the United States, that somehow that if things aren't the way that I always remember them to be, or if people don't look all like I do, that somehow I'm losing power and influence, or the whole world's going to hell in a handbasket. So I am what for someone who's always taught languages and have been into international languages and cultures, I've always been for openness and diversity and change. And change scares a lot of people. And particularly if you're at a school that prides itself on 130, 40 year tradition, change isn't necessarily taken lightly or easily.
I can feel that some way on like an internal level, because when I came to Ignatius, there was a lot of internal backlash, like from students at my grade school, because they saw St. Ignatius as like this head kind of Ivy League in a way, all white school that's too strict and only white to an extent. And they also had, I don't know if I could say this, but they had the imagery that St. Ignatius was homosexual or something because it was all boys. But of course I ignored all that. And it goes both ways, internally and externally. There's an opposition for diversity and inclusivity for the school.
One of the two things that always surprises me about Ignatius is when you mentioned about the view for many that Ignatius is homosexual because of being entirely boys. I remember when Welsh Jesuit went co-ed, and actually when they announced that they were going to co-ed, that there were students, male students, protesting on the campus. And that just shocked me, because I thought that when I was a student, if they had announced Ignatius was going to go co-ed, I'd have been celebrating, dancing in the streets. So for years, I asked students in classes all the time what they would think of Ignatius when co-ed. And I was amazed that I would always get the same three answers. That number one, they said no, because one, they thought that it would drop, one, that the students wouldn't feel comfortable, which was translation for they couldn't fart in class whenever they wanted to. Number two, they said that it would be a distraction. It's like, what do you think, these women are here just for you to look at? And like, if that's your only academic challenge, you don't need to be here in the first place. And third, they thought it was going to lower the academic rigor of the school. Like, well, half of you dumb jerks wouldn't be here if we brought women in. So actually, it would probably raise the academic level of the school. But I was actually always amazed at how, again, my impression would be that students would just celebrate and love that. But again, that idea of tradition, that for many, like, no, it's always been all boys, all male. And I was very surprised at how strongly there was that backlash against that. And also when you mentioned about feeling the sort of pushback of diversity at the school, I'm also, I'm saddened that sometimes that people don't understand how much students from a diverse background have to go through when they come to the school, that they don't realize that they not only have to deal with impressions of people here at school, but often back home in their own parishes, just as you said. It's like, I, as a student in the 70s, came to St. Ignatius, was dealing with being the only Black in my classes and pushback and reactions for that. Then I get back home, and then I'm called white boy for going to Ignatius for this all-white school. So sometimes you're catching hell on both sides, just trying to be yourself and do your own. And I don't think people recognize as much how much people sacrifice and go through to put up with some of the stuff here, because it's not, fortunately some people may, but it's not as if you've got all a very receptive audience when you come back home and your neighborhood and your friends as well, that some of you as being somehow different or a sellout or not being authentic or yourself or going to a majority white school.
Yeah. And I'd hate to get a little personal, but when I used to hear being called white boy a lot, because I don't have that accent that a lot of people assume Black people have. I don't know why. I think I lost it in early grade school, or I didn't really pay attention to it. And I think to an extent I enjoyed sounding quote unquote proper or whatever. But I don't pride myself to try to force myself to talk a certain way, because I'd rather talk how I want. And I don't know, it's just those internal and external stereotypes bring everyone down and to just a certain box that's not very fair for anybody else who finds themselves outside of either one.
And then from someone who studied language linguistics, that number one thing is like, speaking is a function of the audience. So you have to speak and your audience understands. And if your audience doesn't get you, then you need to change something very quickly. So that, that, and identity is something that is chosen and not something that opposed. So people's quote unquote accents change from circumstance to circumstance, person to person, situation to situation, year to year. And so to think that somehow someone's speech patterns are going to be frozen in one place is just not realistic. You speak to your parents so that you speak differently to your brothers and sister than you do to your brother and father. Like you have me in class when I'm going over register that you normally don't go up to administrators and go, yo, G, what's up? But you probably shouldn't say that to Father Yeow, but the same token, you shouldn't go up to your brother and sister and go, good afternoon, sir, how do you do? That there's just an appropriateness by situation and person.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi
Coates, I always loved his one of his defenses on why white people should never use the N-word, that there's certain words that or some people that should never use because of circumstances that he calls his wife honey. And if for some reason some strange woman came up to him and called him honey, or conversely, he called somebody else honey, that could be problematic. That pragmatics and linguistics, that the people speaking in the situation are crucial to understanding what's going on. And just taking a word in isolation is unrealistic. Who's saying it and to whom is the center of communication?
And going back to our class, off on a tangent a little, I remember being in your class and I did enjoy the class, but like once I found out that you can play games in your Chromebook, that was it for me. I still did well. I do remember doing well. I feel like I could personally could have went a lot farther with Spanish had I not been on my Chromebook during class, you know. But yeah, that's all. Out of curiosity, compared to your student years, how far has Black History Month at the school changed, for good or worse?
Oh, it changed. Well, as a student, there was almost no recognition of Black History Month because there were so few students. When I was a student, in most of my classes, I was the only Black student, or occasionally there'd be two of us, but there were four Blacks that graduated in my graduating class. And so there was next to no recognition of Black History Month because it was viewed as a Black thing. And so if you didn't have enough Black students, you didn't need to celebrate Black History Month. There wasn't the recognition that Black history is American history, that it's all a history and a shared history experience. And so going from not only not celebrating, but having no recognition of the need to celebrate it, to starting to have celebrations and recognitions in the 90s, to now having the events and the programs that we have now, we come a very long way. I still think that there is, however, this view that somehow Black history is a separate history, or why don't we have White History Month, or why don't we have Jewish History Month, or the other, that it's not saying that it's a separate history, but it's a recognition of central parts of our history that we sometimes don't spend enough time with. And so if we could get to the point where it's like Black History Month isn't this is the time we're going to talk about Black people, but this is it's more like sort of Advent or Lent, during the liturgical calendar, there's certain times where we emphasize either sacrifice or forgiveness or grace, that it's not something that's separate from the rest of our existence, but something that's essentially part of it, but we just highlight it as opposed to making it a takeaway. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to see it so we get to the point where we can recognize that it's just a recognition of our history and it's just a celebration and not this is something that's an extra.
Yeah, and I think Black History Month gets the most backlash because it is kind of the most nationwide kind of viewed as an event rather because there are other ethnic months like Hispanic Heritage Month, Asian American Month, what's it called? Oh yeah, Irish American Month is actually next month. So I hope to do something with that in coming months. But yeah, there's other examples, but Black History Month is just the most known. And I think people kind of view it as a 1 month holiday of Blacks and or some sort of very simplistic a little too far-fetched idea of Black History Month.
Right, it almost becomes the third. It becomes, well, almost everything in the United States becomes political, particularly when talking about race. And Black History Month becomes almost the third rail, because
definitely,
if you talk about race in the United States, it somehow means if you talk about Blacks, that it somehow must be anti-white, as opposed to it's. I hope I normally move over in class that two of the things that really bother me the most about education in American society is, one, the view that we need to be colorblind, that somehow you should not see color. And that's like saying, well, I shouldn't see the fact that you're Catholic or male or 6 foot or 12 foot. It is a part of who you are. Not recognizing part of your identity is actually an affront to you. So we should be colorful. We should recognize everyone in their wholeness and not explicitly go out of our way to say, no, I don't see you. I don't see you. I don't see you. I don't recognize you. And two, when we often talk about tolerance, that you want to tolerate people, you tolerate snow like today or traffic delays, but you don't tolerate or put up with people. We should talk about a respectful society. And that's one of the reasons I'm very happy and with Dr. Richardson Phillips, that hopefully we're working in that direction with having a position for equity and inclusion. And when we're starting to talk about recognizing the individual and all of their gifts and making them feel not just tolerated or put up with, but welcome.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to note that I feel like the Asian American or the Asian events that we have, like the one for Chinese New Year, I think last week, those always go extremely well. Like like there's potential for people to really enjoy these ethnic events and months, but I just think people have this internal bias against Black History Month in particular, because you don't see it in Native American Month, you don't see it in Hispanic Heritage Month, and you don't see it in Asian American Month. So I don't know. It just feels like there's some sort of push against Black History Month in particular.
Yeah, that's because, again, the legacy of race in the United States often means that, again, if you're recognizing or celebrating Black history, that somehow must mean something again. Or the idea of like Black Lives Matter, and people say like, well, blue lives or white lives or all lives. So that's not the point. Mm-hmm. it's the fact of recognizing if, yeah, that's like the example I hate or love when they talk about all houses matter. Well, that doesn't make that much of a difference if yours isn't burning. It's the house that's burning is the one that needs to be saved, and we're with those that are in danger. So the idea isn't saying that Black lives matter more. It means they matter as much. And if they're in danger, they need to be saved, and not saying they need to be prioritized. And so often in the United States, it becomes race becomes must become exclusionary, that if you celebrate the Black experience, it somehow must be anti-white. And then again, that somehow by doing that, it's often viewed that Blacks then may be getting an advantage and others are losing, that somehow there's unfair affirmative action, which somehow means someone's going to get an unfair advantage, so someone's going to lose. It often becomes, instead of becoming a win-win, it somehow someone has to win either or, instead of becoming an and. And until we can get away from those win-lose scenarios, and my gain has to be your loss, instead of, you know, we're all, a recognition of everyone means that everyone is better off. And then again, a recognition that this is a common shared history and experience, but the idea of trying to marginalize it and quote unquote ghettoize it is what sort of makes the problem, that somehow this is going to somehow an exception or something separate and something that must be detrimental to whites of the majority, as opposed to being part of a shared experience.
Exactly. So out of curiosity, in the classroom, would you say that foreign language classes tend to be the most diverse? Because it is, well, in regards to Saying Nation as a whole, because I don't know, I felt like I found a lot more diversity within those classes, probably because they were required or not, but I don't know.
I feel like putting on my former president of the Ohio Foreign Language Association and as having co-chaired the committee that recently rewrote the state standards for languages, I would like to think so, that the whole purpose of languages now is not just communications. Our newest version actually puts culture on top, that the teaching of culture and acceptance of world cultures is the number one priority of languages. And the communication follows that, because if you don't recognize one's culture, then you wouldn't recognize what's appropriate and how best to communicate with them. So we sort of flipped where before it was communication is the key, and then maybe culture is something you might get to on the side on Friday if you got a few extra minutes, as opposed to putting culture front and center and recognizing the diversity of peoples around the world and their identity and respecting them, and then choosing the most appropriate vehicle or means for appropriately communicating with them, sort of flipping it. So I would hope so, but I know that's not always the case.
I'd like to think that just being a student on my own, I think that during these language classes, we do tend to try to respect as much as possible. I think sometimes if we do disrespect a culture, it's probably an accident, because at the end of the day, it is a learning environment, and it doesn't really benefit anybody to try to make a joke out of it. So I like to appreciate the student body for that.
And also it's we're also recognized for teachers. It also can be hard work, where in the Spanish speaking world, you're talking about over 20 countries and cultures, and in the French speaking world, over 50 cultures on all continents. And then even if you were talking within the Arabic speaking world with almost 20 countries, or even with Chinese within the diversity of that one large country, you have a diversity of peoples and cultures and ranges. So that becomes difficult for teachers as well, to where we often sort of have our strengths, where again, my knowledge of the Hispanic world often tends to be Puerto Rico and Mexico, and in France, often France, but also the Caribbean and Africa. And that's often different from other teachers whose experiences may be more Spain or South America, as opposed to Central America or the Caribbean. And so we try to teach to our strengths, but then also challenges us to, we can't just gloss over what we don't know. It also makes us responsible for diving in and finding out more of that, and hopefully inviting students that have experience to bring that to the classroom and respecting that as well. But it does become a challenge for teachers. It's like, oh my God, I have to teach all of this. How am I supposed to know all of them? Well, you don't necessarily have to know all of them, but you have to be open to teaching about all of them.
Would you say learning new languages is a skill over time? And, or is it like, I don't know, it's like all of your years teaching and learning new languages, does that ever get easier over time?
I wouldn't say it gets easier, but it doesn't get harder. I often say that learning your second language is the hardest. Your native language, people often think that people teach you your first language, and linguistically, it's actually you acquire your own language. You teach yourself your first language. It's just that that's what children are supposed to do. Children really have nothing to do other than eat, sleep, defecate, and teach themselves languages. And that's their job for the first 5 years of their life. Mm-hmm. And they spend so much time doing it, and we're so hardwired to do it, we don't necessarily pay attention to how much work that is, because by the age of five, we get it done. But then after we learn our first language, the hard part is learning the second, because we think everything should be the way our first language is. That if we say in English, we have prepositions, we say in the house. So we expect every other language to have prepositions in the house. And Romance languages and most European languages have that. But then if you go to Japanese, you have postpositions and they say house, the, in. And the hard part for languages, most people go like, why the hell do they say that? Why can't they just say in the house? Why do they have to say house, the, in? And the only answer is because. And until you accept that because, and that some languages have postpositions and some have prepositions, that's the hardest part. As I say, the hardest part is not learning a foreign language, it's forgetting your native language. Once you get past that, 3, 4, 5 are easy. Because once you realize anything's possible, you just say, okay, bring it. Well, what's next? What does this language have to offer? But the hard part is getting to the second, releasing the expectations that you have put on language learning because of the structures of your first language. Once you get open to all the possibilities, it's on.
Yeah, I can see that, because I remember, for example, learning the different verb tenses, and like for the first few, it's kind of straightforward, but it's like, why? But then looking back on it now, it's like English has a worse flaw with verb tenses and whatnot. And at least Spanish has kind of a formula set. English is kind of all over the place. Right. And yeah, I think I learned verb tenses a lot easier after I realized that, one, that because that you said, but two, because it's kind of easier compared to English. So,
That's also one of the fun or odd parts that many times people learn more about their native language by learning another language, because as I said, we, having taught ourselves the language, we don't normally think about it anymore. It just becomes natural, almost like breathing, almost habitual. And so we don't necessarily think about what is the verb tense for here? It just sounds right. Or we don't think about what's a preposition, or do I need a demonstrative adjective as opposed to a possessive adjective? You just do what sounds right and feels right. But when you have to study another language, that makes all of that explicit. All the things that we did out of habit without thinking, now we have to put mental energy into. And hopefully it makes us appreciate what we do and recognize what we do and how we do and become better at it.
So what actually called you to become a teacher or go into foreign language in general?
Well, I'll start off with foreign languages. I always, for some reason, I always liked languages. Although in grade school, I was always in science. I was a big science nerd, science geek. And I always loved writing and loved literature. So it was always the two of those. But when I came to Ignatius, for whatever reason, English and languages just clicked. When I sat down in my English or in my French classes, it felt like I didn't have to study. Everything made sense. Other classes and math and science and the others weren't necessarily that hard, but I had to do more for them. But in French class, it's just like I was a sponge, or in English class, I would read things and I would just remember, and I'd have to write essays and I'd only have to do one or two drafts and I have to write over. It just sort of worked for me. So when I went to college, it's like, well, I don't want to work that hard in college. So let's major in something that seems to be easy for me. So I decided, I was originally thought I was going to be an English and French double major, but at Georgetown, logistically, that wasn't possible because they were in different schools. So I thought I'd ended up being a linguistics and French major, and thought that I was going to go to law school because I worked for a law firm and my mother thought I was going to be a lawyer. I think I'm 58 years old. I think she still thinks one day I'm going to go to law school. But one day after studying abroad in my senior year, I sort of fell out of interest with the law. I just didn't know whether I didn't like a lot of the lawyers who I knew, or a lot of people that were going to law school, and didn't know if that's what I wanted my life to be. So while doing some work in graduate school and odd jobs, I fell into teaching part-time at Clark College in Atlanta, Georgia, where my brother was a student. One of his teachers had been talking about me, that I'd gone to Georgetown and studied abroad and in France, and they were looking for someone to teach a class for a French professor who had eye surgery and was going to be out for a semester. So I accidentally fell into teaching that job. And then at the end of the semester, the Spanish teacher had to leave for personal issues, so they needed somebody to take over four classes for a month at the end of the semester. So since I was there, it's like, okay, well, I guess I can handle it, and did that. And I just kind of fell in love with teaching. I've never been a very patient person, so I thought teaching would be the worst thing in the world for me. But there's that moment of epiphany when students get it, that just, it is very hard work, and it still is hard work, and it's the hardest job that I've ever done. And I've had some pretty bad and crappy jobs, but the payoffs when somebody actually gets it and learns is amazing. And that feeling can get you through months or even years of really bad times. And so when I got invited to teach here at Ignatius and moved back to Cleveland, I took that advantage. So I've had some difficult days, but my worst day at Ignatius is still better than some of my best days in some of the other jobs that I had.
Well, then you could also argue that if people don't get it right, you can always put them to a la pizarra.
Exactly. And also one of the things I hope that with languages as well, one of the things I like sort of like about languages is getting used to the idea that you're never going to get everything right. And particularly in a language and learning a language as a second language learner, there will be 4 and 5 year olds that will always speak better than you. Get over it. And you are always going to make mistakes and slips of the tongue. There are always going to be mistakes. Get over that. Just enjoy the joy of communication, that once you get things out and somebody understands, that becomes a magic moment. And I'm also in sports. I've always been a baseball fan. So it's almost like baseball. That in baseball, if you fail 8 times out of 10, that's normal. If you fail 7 times out of 10, you're one of the best in the game. And if you fail 6 times out of 10, you're the GOAT. You're the greatest that ever played. So failure is baked into our existence and baked into the sport, and sort of the same thing with languages. Don't worry about what you get wrong. Worry about what you get right. Because you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff wrong. But just hold on to the times that you get right, and you'll get more and more things right as you go along.
Yeah, I think that translates into a lot of things, including diversity and inclusion, because I think people really want to be on the right side of this, but they never actually figure out a way to connect with people on an individual level. And I think it's when we connect with somebody or empathize with somebody personally, that's when you actually truly become right in the respect that you know somebody. I don't know how else to say it.
Okay. Absolutely. And also with humility, that it's also as human beings, particularly at a Jesuit Catholic school, recognize that we're all sinners and we're not perfect, and that we can learn from everybody, and we've all got a long way to go. And part of God's grace is putting other people in front of us to give us to help us along the way. And once we recognize that we don't have it all figured out and we all need each other and we all can learn from each other, that's part of the growing path. Again, God's actively out there loving us, trying to show us his love through many people and many vehicles as possible, if we're just humble enough and still enough to listen and willing to accept it.
On an individual level or the language department as a whole, have you aided in to increase in diversity within the school?
Well, I would hope to say that I have within my class again, but in French and Spanish classes, by hopefully not just teaching Spain and bullfighting, or not just teaching France and Paris, that I've tried to specifically bring in multiple cultures from the beginning in both of those. And particularly in French, I have a very particular interest in Caribbean and African cultures. And I've done Fulbrights in Morocco and Tunisia and Vietnam. So I've tried to pull in those experience, and then in Spanish, from Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, different places that I've been and tried to pull in appreciation for the multiple cultures there. And as well as as a result of my Fulbrights in Morocco and Tunisia, I also was part of an NEH program for 2 years where I learned Arabic, kind of like you said, with learning another language. After a while, I decided I needed to sort of keep myself, if I'm telling my other students what it's like to teach a language, I need to also occasionally stretch out and learn what that's like, because if I've been doing this 10, 20, 30 years, yeah, it seems obvious to me. But then if I put myself in a situation where it's something I don't know, I have to be aware of what that feels like. And so part of that was with learning Arabic as well, then trying to expand not only in the French-speaking world with North Africa and the Middle East, but also the Arabic had a huge influence on Spanish in terms of vocabulary and structure. There's the great usted debate that many often claim that usted probably came from the Arabic ustad, the word for professor, and not from vuestra merced, as many traditionalists will say, which to me makes a lot more sense, that if you have an honorific of Ustad, which became Usted, in a place where they had the convivencia, people living together, made a lot more sense than changing vuestra merced, some of the vuestra te vuestra vuestad. And that doesn't pass the smell test.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful how foreign language majors and things alike have that, like, they include ethnicity and diversity, like, as their job. And that just kind of spreads itself in a way. You might not even, like, you might not even realize it. And I think that's why I like, for example, a lot of people like Language Week, because it's not a, it doesn't even really hint at race. It hits a lot at just accepting the richness of cultures across the world and within the country as well.
And that's also one of the reasons I love humanities. And again, nothing against the math and the sciences, because they also have the same structure as well, but perhaps it's not as explicit. But in languages and humanities, it's often right up front that there is no one right answer. And so you have to grapple with uncertainty. Now, there may be an expected answer in math or in science, but then it may not exactly be right. And then you also have to show your work. And there is some ambiguity in that as well. It just often is introduced in the first day of Algebra 1 or the first day of biology. You get that later on. But in languages, you start off on day one. Well, sometimes it's salut and sometimes it's bonjour and sometimes this is right and sometimes it's wrong. And some students deal with that ambiguity and that wiggle room right away with that area of gray right away. And for other students, they never get used to it because it's supposed to be 1.5. The answer should be the answer all the time. It's like, well, in the humanities, it's not always, and you just sort of have to grapple and deal with that.
Maybe that's why people say to keep race out of politics in a way, and to have that and to have that uncertainty of ethnicity in our cultures, because people want to be right all the time,
and oftentimes they want to be polite because they want to. They don't want to be uncomfortable. And often dealing with important topics makes people uncomfortable. I laugh quite a bit. And when you mentioned that in the United States, it's often said, never talk about religion or politics. So those are two things that are taboo. And yeah, I'm a Catholic who teaches at a Catholic school, and I have a master's degree in political science. All I ever do is talk about religion and politics.
I think that the only difference is that it feels genuine. It doesn't feel like it's only a political lens. It feels like it's coming from a human rather than just an entity, you know?
Right.
And I think once people really break that barrier of think of race as a topic rather than just something that needs to be discussed and argued about.
Right. Because I think in the United States, we have sort of two problems that we either want to, everything is a competition, so it's always win-lose, or everything's a problem that has to be solved. And so if we stop thinking of race or even politics or something as a competition where I have to win, therefore you have to lose, or somehow it's a problem that has to be solved, that somehow I have to fix you, or even I have to fix myself. No, it just is what it is. It's part of the fabric. And so if we can just accept it as part of who we are and not as a competition where I'm going to best you or you're going to best me or I win or you lose or I'm going to solve you, solve me, that we're just going to explore where we are and hopefully become better people out of that. But yeah, exactly. I think we always, in the U.S. culture, we either have to win or it's a problem to be solved. We're the can-do people. We got to solve the problem and move on to the next challenge. We landed on the moon. Now we got to go to Mars. Well, sometimes you just have to sit back and relax and look at the sunset.
So, do you think that any issues at the school seem to persist, or have any issues actually gone from since you came here, or very dwindled?
The issue of race and traditionalism still persists. I think we still are very much afraid of dealing with issues of equity and inclusion. And sometimes people ask me, has it gotten better at Ignatius? Or is it worse? It's just different. And when you only have 10 students in the school, then there's a different, you're almost invisible. People can act. I actually heard people say, we don't have a race problem at Ignatius because we don't have enough blacks for there to be a race problem. That is, if you don't see people of color, then they can't be an issue. Part of the issue we have now is that we're more visible. So you can't go through a class and not see one or even two, three, four, five students of color in the class. And that creates a pushback. There often tends to be an automatic reaction. And so I think that's sort of where we're at. Now we've gone from the stage of having just tokens or being invisible to you're starting to have a presence, and part of that presence often can be acceptance, but it often creates a pushback. And so it's how do people get comfortable with that? Because the reaction is either to automatically increase it or to make people go away, and sort of dealing with the now is all right. So for me, that's one of the big issues. And one of my favorite mentor teachers told me for years that Ignatius is, and the longer I've been there and the older I get, I agree with him entirely, that Ignatius is a great place. We are great at sort of solving problems and dealing with crises. That if a crisis happens, we all get together, we have the best minds, we work together, and we get things done. The problem is we can't see a crisis coming to save our lives. We're running into that iceberg every damn time, that we just sort of lack that vision ahead. We're so often so busy putting out the fires and getting rid of those crises that we're so confident in our ability to come together and solve a crisis that we don't do enough to look ahead and predict. Or we're perhaps Pollyannish and just figure that God is going to take care. But those are the two things that sort of, I think, the sort of the pushback from wanting to not deal with the uncomfortable, uneasy issues of race, and being able to look ahead and avoid the iceberg for once, not crashing into it.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like COVID has ironically made relations better here at Ignatius, because I feel like I've been able to connect with other students more through this crisis rather than, I don't know, it just feels like the race barrier is a little less potent because of COVID and the shared experience. And that could be one thing that people assume, that because of the color of my skin, I don't have the same shared experiences, which is true to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, we're all human here and whatnot. And COVID indirectly helped me get closer to some of the students, and I think teachers as well, for this year.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I'm also a comic book fan, so it makes me think of the original comic book of The Watchmen or something. It's like, nothing's greater for bringing people together than an external disaster or an alien. Nothing brings different warring cultures or countries together than an alien invasion, that somehow some external threat can bring enemies together faster than anything else, or make people forget all their petty differences and realize, oh, there's something bigger than all of us. We actually have to work together now. It's sad but true.
I heard that analogy before. It's very true. I think it's probably true. Like, even during something like the Great Depression, people really came together during that time. Or of course, World War II. People came together often, and I'm sure my mom can vouch, because she served in the Navy. There's a lot less racial boundaries in crises like war and physical torment and whatnot versus obviously, like the police force and the judicial system, where it's kind of like people can chill back and others cannot, and there's a disconnect there. But whenever you have a shared experience, it's really evident that these racial boundaries are nonsense.
Right. Like you said, but sometimes it takes, like you said, that humility or the willingness to accept and work with others. But when you realize that you all have a common goal and a common need and a little humility to accept that you can't do it all on your own, then it brings a clarity of focus. So like, yeah, that really wasn't as important or as a big a deal as I thought. This bigger deal is how are we going to meet this next objective? How are we going to get over this hill? How are we going to solve this problem? How are we going to get over COVID and get back into school or have something like a normal graduation?
And I feel like as soon as COVID's over, it'll kind of be all back to normal. Besides the new schedule.
Oh, don't get me started.
As
somebody who used to schedule classes for several years, I was just like, hey, I'm not opposed to change, but it's eye-opening to see a reason for that. So I'm keeping an open mind about a serpentine schedule and 70-minute classes, but as a language teacher, it's just 70-minute classes are great for my third and fourth year. Not having students every day in first and second year is awful. Even if we had students for just 15 to 20 minutes at the beginning of language learning, it's the regularity and the repetition that's the importance. So that's we'll figure out ways until we can, but that's one of the things that really is concerning me about the new schedule is that in the first and second year, of course, is that it's the regular repetition that's needed. That even if you only had students for 15 to 20 minutes every day, it's that every day. And freshmen being able to keep that and know that and not have 70 minutes and then come back the third or fourth day of the snake serpentine schedule and come back and they've forgotten everything and perhaps even relapse and have to reteach. Yes,
it's going to be a great night. It's going to be a change.
That's what we're planning and working on and seeing what we can do in between an asynchronous learning and VHL Central and online and other things to help keep that up, or perhaps creating virtual groups or other types of language labs or required activities outside of the classroom, but it's going to be interesting.
To an extent, I kind of wish I was here to witness it, but I'll be going to college.
You're like, you're going, peace out. Good luck with y'all. That.
All right. So to close off, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's been a great conversation again. Thanks for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure talking and catching up.
Yeah, it's very good talking with you again. Thank you for being here, Mr. Turner, and we'll see you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.